photographs in the lobby of the lodge during construction. One shows the solitary timbers, each standing in its final position before the rest of the lodge was built around them. We had an early dinner in the lounge, and then sat around the huge fireplace with the other guests. It was starting to rain. In northern Montana, it can feel like winter is just around the corner, even on the last day of August. It was very cozy, though. A woman was playing the piano in the lobby. She was very good, but we knew what was coming next. A group sing. That's when we called it a night. We were lying in bed, listening to the rain drum against our windows. From our room, we can hear the singing in the lobby. It's corny and oddly nostalgic, but it will be a nice sound to fall asleep to. Your friend, Matt. From Matt Smith. Subject, Glacier Continued. Date, September 2, 2011. Dear Bob and Sue, the tops of the mountain peaks were dusted with snow when we woke up this morning. It can snow any day of the year in this part of Montana. Our plan for today was to do a long hike starting from the Many Glacier Hotel in the northern section of the park, so we checked out of the Glacier Park Lodge early and got on the road. As we drove past Two Medicine Lake, we saw a black bear on the road close to where we hiked yesterday. I pulled over and got out to try to take his picture. He saw me and began climbing up the hill away from the road, eating berries as he went. This time of year, when the berries are ripe, bears spend every waking moment eating as much as they can. Driving on the road into the park toward Many Glacier Hotel, the scene in front of us was spectacular. The sun broke through the clouds and was in the east behind us as we drove west toward the hotel. I stopped several times to try to capture the scene with my camera. My photos never seemed to capture how amazing the real scene was. We made it to the hotel by mid-morning. Many Glacier Hotel sits on the shore of Swift Current Lake in the northeastern quadrant of the park. It was the largest lodge built by the Great Northern Railway. It's 5 stories tall, with 214 guest rooms. The lobby is essentially a half-sized version of the Glacier Park Lodge lobby, and a section of the lobby has been walled off to create a gift shop, which makes it look even smaller still. Similar to Glacier Park Lodge, builders used huge 40-foot-long timbers from Washington State to frame the lobby. Since it was too early to check into our room, we made sandwiches in the car and prepared for our hike to Grinnell Glacier, an 11-mile round trip from the hotel parking lot. The hike was amazing, one of the best hikes we've done on our park's trip. The weather couldn't make up its mind if it wanted to be summer or winter. We went from hot to cold and back again several times. It rained on us briefly. None of that mattered, though. We were enjoying the hike just the same. The Continental Divide splits the park in half from north to south. Grinnell Glacier sits just below the divide to the east. The glacier is high on a plateau. The runoff spills over the edge of the cliffs and feeds Grinnell Lake below. The lake was a deep green-blue color, and was in front of us to the left for most of our climb to the glacier. It's worth the trip just to come halfway up this trail to sit and look at the falls and the lake below. From the trail, the mountain sloped steeply down to the lake. We could see bighorn sheep grazing below us. They were about a half a mile away, and I needed my binoculars to get a good look. On our way back from the glacier, we saw the sheep again. They had climbed higher on the mountain from where we first saw them. I kept my eye on them, hoping we would get a better look this time. I was glad, but a little surprised, when I saw two bighorn sheep about a quarter mile away standing on our trail. The brush was thick around the area where they were standing, so they chose to use the trail rather than push their way through the bushes. They were moving slowly toward us, and we were moving slowly toward them. When we were about 100 yards away, I realized they weren't going to move off the trail. At that point, there was nowhere for us to go. The bushes were several feet tall and very thick on either side of the trail. They kept coming at us, and the one in front was big, and getting bigger. When they got to about 30 feet from us, I finally realized we needed to get the hell out of their way. The big one in front stopped briefly, looked straight at us, and then lowered his head. His horns wrapped 360 degrees around. He had a full curl. Then he raised his head and continued to stare straight at us. It was a very clear message. He was saying, "This is how big I am. How big are you?" I said to Karen, "We have to get off this trail now."
"Where?"
"Into the bushes," I said. Pushing into the bushes reminded me of when we were in Alaska and had to hike through the wet alder bushes. We got thoroughly soaked in the process. Karen pushed a couple of feet into the thick vegetation. I said, "You're going to have to go farther than that. We need to give these guys plenty of space." With a deep exhale, Karen moved deeper into the soaking wet bushes. The sheep, by this time, had started moving toward us again. We pushed about 15 feet off the trail, which didn't seem like a safe distance, but it was as far as we could go. When the big one reached the point on the trail where we had moved off, he stopped and looked at us. I thought for a moment he was going to turn and follow us. I pulled my bear spray out of the side pocket of my backpack and took the plastic safety cap off the trigger. We always carry bear spray now, after our close encounters in Alaska. The lead sheep stood and looked at us for a moment. We talked to him in a soft, calm voice, hoping he would move along. Finally he did. The one behind him followed. I never thought of bighorn sheep as potentially dangerous animals, and maybe they aren't. But standing a few feet away from this one, I was impressed by his size. He was huge. One pop from his horns would crush a person's chest. We were also spooked because about a year ago a mountain goat in Olympic National Park gored a man. I know, different animal, but still. The goat severed an artery in the man's leg, and he bled to death as the mountain goat stood over him, not letting other hikers come to his rescue. It was frightening to be so close to a wild animal that large, but it was also a thrill. I got a couple of good pictures. I had my camera in one hand and the bear spray in the other. Back at the hotel, we still had some time to kill before we could get into our room, so we went to the bar and ordered fondue. We were expecting it to be like the fondue we ate in Switzerland. A big pot of cheese and a huge basket of bread. It was similar only in name. They brought us a small bowl of cheese that was heated by a votive candle, a couple of pieces of bread, 4 cherry tomatoes, and 6 carrot sticks. Karen called it measly and waved our waiter over twice, asking for more bread. She's a big eater. I like this about her. We spent the rest of the day hanging out in the hotel and driving around the area. We drove to the other hotel down the road, the Swift Current Motor Inn. There wasn't much to see inside the inn, but a crowd gathered in the parking lot. They had cameras and telescopes set up on tripods pointed toward the mountain behind the inn. They were spotting grizzly bears. We tried to find the bears with our binoculars, but they were too far away. Tomorrow we're driving back to Issaquah. We've decided we need to visit Glacier National Park more often. We say this about every park we visit. But this one is so close to home, we have no excuse not to. Your friend, Matt. From Matt Smith. Subject: Kings Canyon National Park Revisited. Date: September 26, 2011. Dear Bob and Sue, Karen gives Kings Canyon National Park one of her highest accolades. She says it's a hidden gem. If you're keeping track, Hidden Gem is just below Magical Place and just above Whoville and Darling on the Karen Smith rating scale. Ramshackle is now the lowest rating a place can get. Shithole was recently removed from the scale. Karen says she prefers to act like a place doesn't exist rather than call it a shithole. This week we're on a road trip from Issaquah to Southern California. We're visiting Channel Islands National Park. Because of the forest fire in Kings Canyon National Park last September, we didn't drive into the canyon, so we decided to go back and see it as part of this trip. Last night we stayed in Clovis, California, and this morning we drove into the park. From the Kings Canyon Visitor Center in Grant Grove Village, we drove north on Highway 180. The highway goes out of the park and through the Sequoia National Forest. It then drops into Kings Canyon and follows the South Fork of Kings River to the east, back into the park. The drive was beautiful. Steep canyon walls, a rushing mountain river, big trees close to the road. If it wasn't so hard to get to, this park would be crowded with people. We saw very few other cars. The highway dead ends in a valley that looks very similar to Yosemite Valley, except Kings Canyon does not have the masses of people, cars, shuttle buses, gift stores, etc. that Yosemite Valley has. John Muir, the original champion of Yosemite, had this to say about Kings Canyon. In the vast Sierra wilderness, far to the southward of the famous Yosemite Valley, there is yet a grander valley of the same kind. It is situated on the South Fork of the Kings River, above the most extensive groves and forests of giant sequoia, and beneath the shadows of the highest mountains in the range, where canyons are the deepest and the snow-laden peaks are crowded most closely together. It was pristine, and in September it was deserted. In the valley we parked our car close to the Cedar Grove Visitor Center. It closed for the year just yesterday, and hiked the Hotel Creek Trail. We hiked to the Cedar Grove Overlook, which was a 5-mile round trip. It was perfect weather for a hike. After we ate PB&J sandwiches for lunch in our car, we drove back to Grant Grove Village. On our way out of the park, we noticed an overhang of smoke. On the Visitor Center bulletin board, a sign was posted saying the Park Service was starting prescribed fires in the park. We drove a short distance to the General Grant Cove, home of the General Grant Tree, and were shocked to see firefighters setting fires at the bases of the big trees. Clearly, they knew what they were doing. They even had a tent set up to explain to visitors how and why they set these fires. The purpose of the fires is to remove combustible material that might ignite if an uncontrolled fire were to come near the big trees. From there we drove to Bakersfield, where we picked up dinner, and then to Oxnard, where we're spending the night. Tomorrow we're visiting Channel Islands National Park. Your friend, Matt. From Matt Smith. Subject, number 55, Channel Islands National Park. Date, September 27, 2011. Dear Bob and Sue, Being from Kansas, I've never seen squid before, unless you count those deep-fried rubber rings that Karen sometimes orders in restaurants. Today, on our boat ride to Channel Islands National Park, there were more jumbo squid than we could count. It looked like there were at least 100 of them feeding close to the surface of the water. One of the deckhands said, "I've been doing this for 38 years and have never seen this before." Large squid were feeding on smaller squid. The captain said the big ones were Humboldt squid, and he called the smaller ones bait squid. As the big ones darted through the water, they would grab the smaller ones with their tentacles. They were flashing, changing colors from black to red, as they chased their breakfast. Sometimes they would come to the surface and squirt streams of water into the air. It was the main attraction this morning on our boat ride to the park, a jumbo squid feeding frenzy. Channel Islands is our 55th national park. At 8 a.m., our boat left from Ventura, California, for Santa Cruz Island, the largest of the five islands that make up the park. The boat ride normally takes an hour, but today we made several stops to look at wildlife. The squid put us behind schedule, but it was worth it. As the boat was pulling into the dock at Scorpion Harbor, the captain reminded us that he would pick us up for the return trip at 3:45 p.m. The boat would leave the island at 4 p.m. sharp. He then repeated the message no fewer than 10 times and made us all answer him when he asked over the public address, "What time does the boat leave?" We shouted back, "4 o'clock." We got the feeling that he wasn't joking when he said that if we missed the 4 o'clock departure, we would be unintentional campers on the island until the boat comes back tomorrow. After a short but mandatory orientation on the beach, we were free to roam the island for 6 hours. We stored our cooler in one of the food caches by the visitor center. The volunteer rangers were adamant that all food brought on the island be stored in the metal food caches. Their main concern is to keep food away from the foxes that live on the island. They don't want them to see humans as a source of food and lose their ability to survive in the wild. It's for their own good. The east quarter of Santa Cruz Island is open to general park visitors. The western three-fourths is a nature conservatory and requires a special permit to explore. We stayed on the national park side of the island, hiking over a 1,400-foot ridge to Smuggler's Cove on the other side. We were the only hikers on the trail. The park literature says the way the island looks today is what most of Southern California looked like before the trees, suburbs, and industrial complexes were built. Rolling hills, tall grass, and not many trees. Being the end of summer, the entire island was the color of dry grass, with the exception of the few trees in the valleys close to the shore. Smuggler's Cove was empty except for a handful of very large crows and a couple of sailboats anchored offshore. At Smuggler's Cove there's an abandoned orchard with hundreds of olive trees, which early settlers planted for subsistence. We felt as if we were the only ones on the island. Had the sailboats not been there, we could have imagined that we were thousands of miles from civilization on a deserted island. Odd, considering we were only a few miles across the water from one of the most populated cities in the U.S., Los Angeles. The hike back to Scorpion Beach was a trudge, although there were decent views of the ocean and nearby islands. The temperature was bearable today, but it can get dangerously hot on Santa Cruz Island, especially for hikers. A couple of years ago, a 49-year-old man hiked 14 miles from Prisoner's Harbor to the Scorpion campgrounds in 94-degree heat. He set out at 11 a.m. and, according to his hiking partners, struggled mightily to reach the campgrounds. By 7:30 p.m., he had died of heat stroke. Once we were back at the beach, we pulled our cooler out of the food cache. Having heard the captain's warning, we made sure we were at the dock early. 2 hours early. We sat at the picnic table close to the dock and ate lunch. On the boat ride back to Ventura, there was more excitement in the channel where we saw the jumbo squid. Dozens of dolphins were swimming near the surface. The captain said they were probably feeding on the squid we'd seen earlier. We had a front-row view of the circle of life. The extraordinary thing about this group of dolphins was that many had babies with them. Our captain called it a nursery. The mothers would come up out of the water with their babies right by their side. The little ones mimicked their mothers. It was really quite amazing. There were dozens of baby dolphins with their mothers. It was way better than a visit to SeaWorld. Tonight we're staying at the Hampton Inn in Oxnard. Tomorrow we're going to cannonball it to Chico, California, to tour the Sierra Nevada Brewery. By the way, since we're almost finished visiting the national parks, Karen and I have decided our next thing will be to tour every brewery on the planet. Maybe you could join us. Your friend, Matt. From Matt Smith. Subject, number 56. Hot Springs National Park. Date, October 24, 2011. Truth be told, of all the parks we've been to, Hot Springs National Park has been the one we had the lowest expectations of prior to visiting. But it's a national park, and we pledged to see them all, so here we are. Last weekend we were in Kansas to visit Matthew at KU. Yesterday morning we drove 7 hours from Overland Park, Kansas, to Hot Springs, Arkansas, the home of the park. The park has about 5,500 acres of land, some of which is heavily treed with hiking trails, but the main attraction is the bathhouses. There's nothing wrong with the trails, but it wouldn't make sense to travel a long distance to get here just for the hiking. The attraction is the mineral water, both hot and cold. The hot water was piped into bathhouses, where people would bathe, believing the hot mineral waters had medicinal benefits. They also drank the cold mineral water coming out of the springs. They still do. We saw many people filling up plastic water jugs from the public spring water faucets. The area that is now the park became a government reservation in 1832. The park brochure says, "It was the first U.S. reservation created to protect a natural resource." In 1921, Stephen Mather, the first director of the National Park Service, convinced Congress to make it a national park. The park literature also says that during the Golden Age of bathing, over 1 million visitors a year came to bathe in the mineral waters. Visitors also strolled the bathhouse row with cups to quaff the elixir. They walked around smelling the water. They say that by the 1950s, changes in medicine led to a rapid decline in the use of water therapies. I should hope so. We first stopped at the visitor center inside the Fordyce bathhouse and took care of business. The Fordyce building, in addition to being the visitor center, is a preserved bathhouse from the Golden Age. Karen and I walked through the rooms in back. Golden Age is an exaggeration. It was very weird. There were stalls that looked like they came straight out of a horror movie. I told Karen it looked like they filmed the Alien Autopsy movie in there. People still come to Hot Springs National Park to bathe in the mineral waters. A couple of the buildings, Quapaw and Buckstaff, still operate as active bathhouses. One of the old bathhouse buildings, the Ozark, has been converted into an art museum. I can see that it made sense at one time for Hot Springs to be a national park, when people believed bathing in the mineral waters improved their health. But now that's an obsolete idea, a novelty. Hot Springs National Park is more about historic preservation than an activity destination. After visiting the park, Karen and I walked to a Mexican restaurant by our hotel. We ordered margaritas in memory of 2011, the summer of the margarita. This morning we woke up to a cold and foggy day. Instead of hiking, we drove the Hot Springs Mountain Drive through the park and then on to Little Rock. Right now we're sitting in the Little Rock Airport waiting for our plane. We should get back to Seattle tonight about 10 p.m. Your friend, Matt. From Matt Smith. Subject: Death Valley National Park Revisited. Date: January 13, 2012. Dear Bob and Sue, a borax museum? I can't believe there's enough interest in borax for it to have its own museum. Don't say that in front of the lady running the Borax Museum in Death Valley National Park. I made this mistake and had to listen to a lecture about why borax is the most important mineral known to man. It's a key ingredient in household cleaners. It's a fire retardant. It's used as a flux in making glass and ceramics. Pyrex couldn't be made without borax. It's even used to control radioactivity in nuclear power plants. But my favorite use for borax, it's used to make slime, the silly putty stuff we used to make with our kids. No, do not make fun of borax. At least not in the Borax Museum. Borax was mined in the area that is now the park until as recently as 2005. Mining is the only conceivable reason why humans would inhabit such an inhospitable place as Death Valley. Karen and I visited Death Valley National Park in September 2010, but then we were pressed for time, and the temperature in the park was well over 100 degrees. We came back now in January because it's an ideal time to see the park without the oppressive heat. The average daily high temperatures from May through September are over 100 degrees, but in January the average daily high is in the upper 60s. The easiest way for us to get to the park from Seattle is to fly to Las Vegas, rent a car at the airport, and drive. That's how we got here yesterday. It was about a 2-hour drive. We're staying at Furnace Creek Ranch, close to the Furnace Creek Visitor Center, smack in the middle of the park. Death Valley National Park is the largest national park in the lower 48 states. It's roughly 120 miles long and 40 miles wide. We looked online at the inn at Furnace Creek across the highway from the ranch, but their rooms were much more expensive. Our room at the ranch is just fine. We didn't feel the need to spend extra to stay at the inn. The inn has a nice bar and restaurant, but we can drive over there for dinner, then come back to the ranch to sleep. Besides, the ranch has a general store, several restaurants, a saloon, and the Borax Museum. The paved roads in the park are well-maintained and suitable for everyday vehicles, but there are many rough, gravel side roads that lead to some of the best parts of the park, the backcountry areas. The valley runs through the center of the park. Mountains flank it to the east and west. In the mountains there are countless slot canyons that are spectacular to hike and drive through, if you have the right type of vehicle. Our rental car doesn't have high clearance, nor does it have the kind of tires needed to drive over the sharp rocks and rough roads in the backcountry. That's why I reserved a Jeep for 2 days from Farabee's Jeep Rentals. Richard Farabee rents Jeeps that are equipped to handle the unpaved roads in the park. His shop is just across the highway from the inn at Furnace Creek. We were there at 8 a.m. this morning to pick up our Jeep. Renting a Jeep isn't cheap, but it's less expensive than breaking down in the middle of nowhere and having Richard tow you out. Richard also runs a tow service. I asked him, "How much do you charge for a tow?" "Well," he hesitated, "I charge $200 an hour. I said, some of the places where people could get stuck are a couple of hours or more from here. That could get expensive. Yeah, we pull people out of the racetrack all the time. From here, that's a 5-hour trip. It costs them $1,000 just to get their car back here to my shop, and I don't fix them. I just tow them. If they've rented a car in Las Vegas, they have to make arrangements with their rental car company to get it fixed or towed back to Las Vegas. It can be a pretty expensive outing. Just the other day, I pulled two cars out of Echo Canyon. Both belonged to the same group of guys. They were on a bachelor party. This seems to be a popular bachelor party spot. Anyhow, both cars lost their oil pans trying to get up into the canyon. That kind of put a damper on their party. Inside Richard's office, he pulled out a map of the park and highlighted several popular roads and sites we could explore. We decided on our itinerary for the next couple of days, and Richard wrote it down, not just for us, but also for him to keep. He said he likes to keep track of where people are in the park, just in case they run into trouble. Our first destination was Titus Canyon. From Richard's shop, we drove north through the park toward the ghost town of Rhyolite. We had to drive a couple of miles outside the park to pick up the one-way road that would take us over Red Pass and then through Titus Canyon. It didn't take long after we turned onto Titus Canyon Road to realize we'd made the right decision to rent a Jeep. The road was so rough that we would have never made it in our rental car. About 8 miles from where we entered the road, just past Red Pass, we came to the ghost town of Leadfield. Richard told us that every road in the park exists because it once led to a mine. The 15-mile Titus Canyon Road was built to provide access to Leadfield. No one lives there now, but in 1926 the town had 300 residents and a brand-new post office. Leadfield is a good example of the boom-and-bust nature of mining in the early 20th century. Very little ore was ever mined at the site, and by early 1927 the residents deserted the town. West of Leadfield, the road drops in elevation, and the walls of the canyon squeeze in on both sides. For several miles, the road follows the twisting path of the Slot Canyon. At times, the road is barely a single car's width, the reason why it's a one-way road. Once the road exits the canyon, the gravel continues for another mile or so before it reaches the paved main park road. If we had more time, I would have driven that road again. It was that beautiful of a drive. On our way back to Furnace Creek, we stopped at Stovepipe Wells Village to fill the Jeep with gas. You always need to keep an eye on the fuel gauge when you're driving in Death Valley. Distances can be deceiving, and there are only a couple of places to get gas. Just outside the village, we stopped at the Mesquite Flat Sand Dunes and hiked out onto the dunes. Many people who haven't been to Death Valley think the park is mostly sand dunes, but less than 1% of it is covered with dunes. Sand from the eroding canyon walls is carried by the wind and trapped between the mountain ranges. In a few places, it piles up into sand dunes. The Mesquite Flat sand dunes are about 100 feet tall, and once you walk into them and are surrounded by sand, you feel like you're in the Sahara. We climbed to one of the highest dunes and plopped down in the warm, soft sand. We sat there looking at the mountains change colors as the sun set. Your friend, Matt. From Matt Smith. Subject: Death Valley National Park continued. Date: January 14, 2012. Dear Bob and Sue, the place I wanted to see the most in Death Valley National Park was the racetrack. It's not an actual racetrack. It's a dry lake bed, or playa, tucked between the Cottonwood Mountains and the Panamint Range on the west side of the park. It's named the racetrack because on the dry lake bed are rocks that move. They appear to be racing one another across the desert. No one has ever seen the rocks move, but when they do, they leave tracks of their path. I can't think of a stranger sight we've seen on our entire park strip. To get to the racetrack, we had to drive on a washboard, rutted gravel road for 28 miles. That's 28 miles one way. We rarely went faster than 15 miles per hour. Just getting there took over 2 hours from when we left the paved road. And that was with half the length of the road having been recently graded smooth. I now understand why Richard gets calls to tow cars out of this area of the park. We passed several crowded minivans that should not have been driving this road. A few miles short of the playa is Tea Kettle Junction, a fork in the road that leads to an abandoned mine. It's become popular for people to hang tea kettles on the Tea Kettle Junction sign. There were dates and messages written on the kettles. Some looked brand new, others were rusted antiques. At first glance it looked trashy, but at the same time it was an interesting sight. The sun reflecting off the kettles made them look like jewels in the desert. I liked it. We took our picture by the sign. We were lucky to be able to get an early start this morning. By renting the Jeep for 2 days, we skipped having to wait in line this morning to pick it up. When we got to the playa, there were only a couple of other visitors there. The playa looked like the kind of dry lake bed you would see on TV commercials for sports cars, where the cars are speeding across an endless flat surface with mountains in the background. At first, that's why I thought this particular dry lake bed was called the racetrack. The distance across the playa was deceptive. From where we parked, we could easily see to the other side, which looked to be a short distance away, maybe a couple of city blocks in length. But once we got onto the playa and started walking toward the rocks in the distance, it seemed as if we were walking in place. It was at least a mile and a half across the playa. After a few minutes, we reached several small rocks, but didn't see any sign of movement or tracks. I thought for a moment that maybe this was a big goof, and there weren't any moving rocks. Then we found one. It was square and about a foot and a half wide on each side. It was just sitting there in the early morning sun like it probably has every morning for dozens, if not hundreds, of years. But trailing away behind it was a slightly curved, indented path in the dry, hard playa surface. It looks like someone got down on their hands and knees and pushed it across the lake bed when the mud was wet, and then the trail hardened when the lake bed dried. But there were no signs of footprints or handprints or any prints except the path the rock made as it raced across the playa. As we walked farther, we saw many other rocks that had moved, each with a trail coming from a different direction. Some of the trails even crossed each other. Whatever was causing these rocks to move, it wasn't a force that moved in the same direction. If it had, all the trails would also be moving in the same direction. Still early in the morning, the sun was at a low angle. It was a perfect time to photograph the rocks, because the light caused a slight shadow on the ridges of the rocks' trails. Had the sun been directly overhead, the trails would have been difficult or impossible to see in our pictures. There are several theories about how the rocks move. The most plausible is that strong winds come through the valley, and when the lake bed is wet, the surface is slippery enough for the wind to push the rocks along their path. If that were true, though, why would the paths be moving in different directions? And some of the rocks are too big for the wind to move them. A few that we saw looked to be at least a couple of 100 pounds. Then there are people who believe that aliens move the rocks. Of course they believe that. Whatever the correct explanation is, I'm glad no one has ever seen it happen. It keeps the mystery alive. While we were walking amongst the mysterious rocks, we met another couple. They were older. I'm guessing they were in their 70s. They told us that they had been to this playa years ago, and back then there were more rocks. People, it seems, have been coming to the racetrack and taking the rocks. How stupid and selfish is that? It's not the rocks that are special. It's the fact that they move mysteriously, and no one can figure out how it happens. On the way back to the car, I began noticing trails in the playa that would stop abruptly with no rock at the end. Rock poachers. We were fortunate to pass only a few cars on the way to the racetrack. The road was rarely wide enough for two cars to pass safely while both were moving at the same time. One of the two cars would have to pull over and let the other pass. As we were leaving, we could see several rooster tails of dust in the distance approaching us. The jeeps were coming. With our high-clearance vehicle, we were always able to find a spot to pull over and let an approaching car pass, except once. It was a particularly narrow stretch of the road, and the graded gravel made a high bank on either side that was too high to climb over with our jeep. The other car, also a jeep, approached us and stopped. We were facing each other, and neither of us could pass. Looking behind me, the nearest place I could see to pull over was a long way off, at least a quarter mile. I wasn't going to back up into a cloud of dust with zero visibility for a quarter mile. I could see a spot 50 feet ahead where the other jeep could back into. I got out and told the other driver if he just backed up a short distance, we could pass each other. He didn't speak a word of English, and he looked terrified from having driven on the rough road. I kept motioning for him to back up, but he shook his head no. He must have thought I was telling him that he had to back up for the entire length of the road, several miles. Finally, he understood me, backed up, and we made it through. That guy was in for a long day. We explored other areas of the park with our jeep. The Ubihibi Crater, Mosaic Canyon, and Echo Canyon. Toward the end of the day, we went back to the Stovepipe Wells Village gas station, filled up with gas, and bought refreshments. Karen and I drove to the sand dunes and hiked back to our favorite dune with my backpack filled with beer and snacks. We took off our shoes and socks and rested our heads on our backpacks. Lying there, watching the sun set on the stunning vista, we were deeply satisfied. Our parks trip has been more than we expected when we started out. More incredible, more expensive, more exhilarating, more time-consuming, more eye-opening. I can see us doing it all again. We've now visited 56 of the 58 parks. We've gone as far as we can without going back to Alaska and getting in a small plane. We're still not ready for that. The two parks we have left, Kobuk Valley and Gates of the Arctic, are both north of the Arctic Circle in Alaska. They're wilderness parks with no roads or visitor services. We'll have to hire a guide to take us in. We plan on visiting them this August, once the bugs are gone, but before it starts snowing. It's not too late for you to join us. Your friend, Matt. From Matt Smith. Subject, Unfinished Business. Date, May 26, 2012. Dear Bob and Sue, it's time to take care of some unfinished business. With my new job about to start, Karen and I are off to Grand Teton and Grand Canyon National Parks. We don't feel we properly visited these parks on our first pass-through. It's going to be a 4,000-mile, old-fashioned road trip. Last night we drove from Issaquah to Coeur d'Alene, Idaho, where we stayed at the Days Inn. Before going to bed, Karen suggested we shouldn't be in a hurry in the morning, that we should feel good if we were on the road by 8 a.m. This morning, at 5:45, she said to me, Why are we just laying around?
We were on the road by 6:30.
It was sunny when we started out, but that only lasted about 20 minutes. By the time we got to Butte and stopped for lunch, it was snowing. We're celebrating the beginning of summer by driving back into winter. Just east of Bozeman, I noticed a car next to us in the left lane. Whenever I sped up or slowed down, it would too. This was very annoying and a little dangerous, given that we were driving through a snow shower. After several minutes, I looked over to see the driver, a young woman, with a Dairy Queen sundae in one hand and texting on her phone with the other hand. She must have been steering with her knees. Apparently, the curvy mountain roads, the snow, and the traffic were not enough to hold her attention. Eventually, she sped away and disappeared into the distance. By mid-afternoon, we arrived in Gardiner, Montana, where we're staying tonight. Gardiner is a small town that sits just north of the Yellowstone National Park border along the Yellowstone River. Several years ago, when we were here with the kids, we spent a couple hours poking through the stores. One had an impressive offering of animal pelts, from grizzlies to weasels. It was on that trip I got the idea to start a pelt collection. I didn't buy any pelts at the time because I thought they would be plentiful on our travels through the West. They're not. Since then, I've regretted not buying a pelt, and I've mentioned it to Karen so often that she's tired of hearing about it. She doesn't like the idea of me accumulating a closet full of dead animals, but she prefers that to listening to my laments. Karen's been looking forward to our trip back here so I can finally buy a pelt, although she's said there's one condition. We're only buying pelts of animals that died of old age or were road-killed. When we pulled into Gardiner this afternoon, the light rain that had been falling was turning to a mix of rain and snow. Standing under the eaves of the Old West storefronts, we could barely see the Roosevelt Arch just a few hundred yards away. We walked the entire length of the row of shops, but couldn't find the pelt store. I was in a mild state of panic. What if they went out of business? Where would I get my pelts? What if there are no more pelts? What if... Karen could sense my growing anxiety, so she distracted me with an offer of food and drink. We stopped in a bar to have a beer. There were only two other people in the place, besides the bartender and us. Karen did her best to calm me down. There had been one closed shop along the strip with a "We Just Stepped Away" sign on the door. She assured me that was the pelt store, and we would go back later this afternoon. I wasn't so sure. I had looked through the windows of the closed store and hadn't seen any pelts. In an attempt to end my worries, she waved the bartender over to ask him about the pelt store. I thought to myself, "Here we go." He walked over and leaned toward us across the bar. The crucifix tattoo on his arm brushed against my beer. Jesus was staring right at me. Karen said,
"Excuse me, where's the pelt store?"
"What kind of pelt you looking for?" Karen just stared back at him, suddenly mute. "I got a bear pelt outside in my trunk I'd sell you. The bear charged me during bow season, so I shot it in the head with my .45 pistol." Karen squeezed my thigh under the bar. She was silently asking me if we should run for our lives. Doing her best to act like she shops for bear pelts regularly, she asked,
"What type of bear was it?"
"A black bear." There was a pause. After a confident sniff, he continued, "Yeah, it's the 15th largest black bear shot in Montana."
We weren't sure if he meant that it was the 15th largest black bear shot in the head in Montana, or if it was the 15th largest black bear shot anywhere in Montana. Karen replied, "I'm looking for something a little smaller than a bear." The bartender could tell she didn't have a clue what she was looking for.
When he left to serve one of the other customers, Karen turned to me and said,
"Everything about that exchange was offensive."
I replied, "Where's the pelt store? What was that? We might as well be wearing T-shirts with stupid tourist printed on them." She said, "I should have asked him if he has the 15th smallest penis in Montana." I was glad their conversation ended so quickly. For a moment I thought we would end up in the parking lot, digging through this guy's trunk full of animal remnants. I could imagine a stray antler accidentally setting off one of his loaded weapons. After we left the bar, Karen agreed not to start any more conversations with strangers in Montana or anywhere about pelts. I'm still peltless, though, except for the two rabbits Karen has packed away with her Christmas ornaments, and those have glitter on them. Your friend, Matt.
From Karen Smith. Subject: If I Had a Hammer. Date: May 28, 2012. Dear Bob and Sue, Memorial Day weekend is supposed to be the kickoff to summer. In Yellowstone, it was still winter. Many of the roads in the park were closed yesterday morning when we drove through on our way to Grand Teton National Park. The snow from the recent storm was still being plowed. Fortunately, there was one route open, so we were able to drive through the park and exit to the south rather than taking the six-hour detour around the park entirely. When we stopped at the Old Faithful Visitor Center, Matt was disappointed because their pelt collection was not on display. He likes to look for the bullet holes, but you already know that. When we pulled up to our cabin in Coulter Bay Village, we were surprised that it was on a lake. Not Jackson Lake, which is down the street, but a huge puddle right outside our front door. Matt quickly named it Smith Lake. He estimated that the parking lot hadn't been draining properly for at least a couple of years, leaving a puddle about 10 yards long and a half foot deep in some places. We had to park in front of another cabin and drag our luggage around the lake and through some long wet grass to get to the front door. Matt said weeds were blocking the water's path to the drainage ditch, and if he had the proper tools, he could easily fix it. We looked in and around the cabin, but couldn't find anything he could use to clear a channel for the water to escape. We also looked in the car. I asked Matt if there was a small shovel in our emergency roadside toolkit. He said no, there wasn't a shovel, but he did pack a hammer. We had a lengthy debate about why he would choose to bring a hammer over a small shovel. It seemed to me that in an emergency, like getting stuck in the snow or coming across a forest fire, a shovel would be useful. I pointed out that a hammer isn't a tool usually called upon for any kind of rescue attempt, unless you need to bludgeon someone. Matt dismissed my opinion and assured me that a hammer is an essential emergency tool. Whatever. A little while later, we left our cabin to drive to the visitor center to take care of business. I asked Matt to stop by the rental office so I could inform them we had a lake where our car should be. "Tell them your husband needs a hoe," he called out to me as I jumped out of the car. At the front desk, I waited for a few minutes while other guests checked in. When it was my turn, the front desk clerk looked at me expectantly. "May I help you?" "My husband needs a hoe." The woman stared at me blankly. She didn't get Matt's humor. I explained the problem to her, and she said, "Our maintenance workers are over at the lodge until 5 o'clock, and when they get back here, they won't have time to deal with anything unless it's an emergency." I tried again, this time changing my request to a shovel. "My husband can take care of the problem." "I'm sorry, we can't give our guests tools. They might hurt themselves." Okay, then how about a life jacket? I thought to myself. The next morning, after Matt went on a coffee run, we got dressed in layers for our hike in the snow. Matt said he had to get something out of the car, and when he didn't return, I glanced out the front window of the cabin. I saw him at the edge of the lake, hacking away at the weeds with the claw end of his hammer. And that is why I love this man. I found the camera and took some pictures of him in action. The man staying in the cabin next door, who was also inconvenienced by the lake, came out and wandered over to watch him. I'm pretty sure he thought Matt was a maintenance worker, although he must have wondered why Matt was using a hammer. His only comment to Matt was a sarcastic, "Thanks for doing this now, just as I'm ready to check out." I couldn't decide if this guy was the dumbest man on the planet or the bravest. Who takes that tone with someone straddling a weed patch, splattered with mud, crazily wielding a hammer? It took Matt only about 10 minutes of hacking for the water to flow freely into the drainage ditch. Afterward, he wiped off his hammer, put it back in the emergency roadside kit, and came into the cabin. We stood at the window and watched the water drain. Matt pointed to the stream of water flowing into the drainage ditch. "See there?" he said. "That's Smith Creek." Matt stayed there in the window, watching with pride as Smith Lake drained into Smith Creek. And then the lake and the creek were gone. Just wet pavement remained. Matt turned to me with a sigh. I needed a win. Now, and for the rest of our road trip, I'll have to listen to Matt talk about what a great idea it was for him to pack a hammer. So much better than a shovel. Your friend, Karen.
From Matt Smith. Subject: Hiking in the Tetons. Date: May 28, 2012. Dear Bob and Sue, while I would be happy to believe that Grand Teton means big breast, no one knows for sure if that's the correct origin of the name. The French owned the land that's now Grand Teton National Park prior to the 19th century, and since Teton means breast in French, nipple actually, some think the mountains were named Tetons because they look like big breasts. After some quick research, I'm not convinced this is the correct etymology of the name, but it works for me. With Smith Lake drained, I was ready for a hike in the Tetons. From Coulter Bay, we drove to Jenny Lake. On the way, we saw several cars parked alongside the road. People were standing on the shoulder looking toward a meadow. A brown bear, a grizzly, was pawing the ground in search of food about 100 yards from the road. It never stops being a thrill to see a bear in the wild. There are very few places in the lower 48 states that are home to grizzlies, but the federal government has protected Yellowstone for so long, since 1872, that it and Grand Teton, to its south, still have brown bear habitats. Grand Tetons also has a diverse population of other large mammals, moose, elk, and black bears. At Jenny Lake, we wanted to hike into Cascade Canyon, but when we spoke with the ranger, he told us it would be a treacherous hike today because of the newly fallen snow. Instead, we hiked the trail that circles the lake. We asked the ranger at the visitor center if there had been any bear sightings close to the lake. He showed us a map with a couple of shaded areas with dates indicating recent